This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I am really appreciative of all you coming out. I'm honored to give the Burke Lectureship the kind of ethical introspection and commitment to civil discussion that Father Burke represented. You know, has never been more necessary than today. And I think the Charlie Kirk assassination has made us all think about the way our society is deeply divided. I mean, the fact that we could have such a brutal assassination and a response to it as a country is not to come together in revulsion, but rather to be even more divided, I think speaks to some of the real challenges that we face as a country. So my job is to try to see if we can do a little healing over the next hour or so. The kind of journalism that I do, I spent a career covering war and genocide and addiction and trafficking and other issues. It's kind of an unusual path. So I thought I would talk a little bit about how I came on that path and some of the lessons learned along the way. And one of the real milestones for me came when my wife and I moved to Beijing to be Beijing correspondents for the New York Times. And let me introduce my wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn. Cheryl, you want to stand up? Come on, got to stand up. Cheryl, as you know, has been my co-author in our books. People always ask us how we can write books together and stay married. You know, the truth is that if you can raise three kids together and stay married, a book is a piece of cake. But when Cheryl and I moved to China as correspondents for the New York Times, so we had to live in the official residence of the New York Times, and we knew that it was bugged partly because partly because one of our Chinese friends worked part-time for state security, translated conversations in our building. But we didn't know exactly where the bugs were. And then a friend came and he pointed to this kind of grate in the entranceway. And he said, behind that grate, that's where the bugs are. So we were moving in. We thought we'd get to the bottom of this. So I got a ladder, got a hammer, knocked down the grate, and there's this kind of shoebox-sized cubbyhole behind it with all this electronic gadgetry. And I was so impressed with myself because I just spent a year studying Chinese full-time, and I recognized the Chinese characters on the big device in front there. And the Chinese characters read, electronic sound carrying device. We had nailed it. So Cheryl and I disappear, and you know, Cheryl and I were really well prepared for this moment because we'd read a lot of spy novels. So we go to the bathroom and turn the shower on and turn the faucets on and whisper in each other's ears. And you know, we figure we've got a couple of options here. We could leave the bug in place, or we could smash it, or we could leave it in place and use it as a disinformation channel to the Chinese government, to state security. So you're a smart crowd, so what would you do? I'm going to put you on the spot. So how many of you would, you know, well-behaved option, how many of you would leave it in place? Show of hands. Okay. How many of you would smash it? I'm just going to take a few names down for the Chinese government. They pay me here. See if you ever get a visa. And how many of you would leave it in place but use it as disinformation channel to state security? Okay, well, great minds think alike. You know, Cheryl and I were so proud of ourselves that we had figured this out. We just arrived in Beijing and we've already mastered the state security apparatus. And then just at that moment when we had it all figured out, a friend arrived at the front door and we found out what an electronic sound carrying device is in Chinese. It's a doorbell buzzer. Well, we were utterly deflated. But it was really useful, frankly, to be deflated in that way and to be reminded that when you do think that you really have it all figured out and are utterly confident and full of hubris and pride, that that's the moment to beware of your self-confidence and the arrogance that comes with it. And that's certainly useful for a foreign correspondent, or even more so for a newspaper columnist who bounces into countries and, you know, talks to people for a few days or a week and then bounces out. But I think it's also a lesson about the importance of humility that we all can use and that the country can use. And, you know, I think about the aftermath again of the Charlie Kirk assassination and the way wherever we were on the spectrum, we tended to be subjected to selection bias and to think that the problem of political violence is essentially what of the other side and that we are fundamentally victims of it. And, you know, it is striking how that narrative is very present on both sides. And the truth is that absolutely, you know, this is a problem that afflicts the whole country. And both sides have been victimized by it. And both sides have had people who have perpetrated it. And one of the things that, I mean, one of the lessons you get as a journalist when you're unfortunately leaving things that can be found for people to find on the internet later on is just how easy it is to make mistakes. And I look back. And I think that as a country, you know, some humility is pretty useful for all of us. And I, look, I'm a liberal. We liberals, many within the center left, made or were a party to one of the great mistakes of the 20th century in terms of the world. And that was that there was an awful lot of softness toward Soviet and Chinese communism in the 20th century in the left. That was a profound misjudgment. Meanwhile, if you look at domestic policy, the right made, I think, an equally profound mistake. And again, obviously not everybody, but civil rights was one of the fundamental tests of moral character domestically. And that was an area where much of the right got it wrong. So I think both left and right have reasons to be aware, to beware when they feel a little bit too self-confident, to remember that we all have this capacity to make mistakes even about the things we truly believe are obvious and important. And, you know, one of the things I wrestle with is as a journalist who tells people what to think twice a week, and yet also was very aware of all the mistakes I make. You know, how do I reconcile that contradiction? And my own effort to do so fundamentally revolves around the idea that there are fundamental moral challenges that we face around the world. And we should unflinchingly stand up for what we believe in. And yet at the same time, recognize those things that seem so obvious may be wrong. And 5 years down the road, we may realize we were wrong. And when you accompany that willingness to make moral calls with an acknowledgement that you may be wrong, you're a little bit less likely to wag your finger and shout down the other guy, none of which is ever very effective in persuading anybody. And so that's what I try to do, not always successfully. Well, another of my sort of, I think, fundamental lessons, something that really changed me, came about 6 months after that electronic sound carrying device issue. The Tiananmen democracy movement began. And I look back at my coverage of the student democracy movement with a certain amount of embarrassment, because I periodically wrote that the workers in particular, that they talk about how they're for democracy, but they can't define the kind of democracy that they're for. They can't talk about the institutions they would develop, the guardrails they would place. And there was an element of truth to that. But that terrible night of June 3rd to 4th, 1989, when I was on Tiananmen Square and saw trucks of soldiers roll in and open fire on that crowd that I was in, some of the bravest people that night were precisely these workers and peasants who might not have been able to define the democracy they wanted or describe the institutions, but were ready to die for it. And I particularly think of on the old airport road, I'm sure some of you have been on, now it's been replaced by a highway, but back then there was the Beijing Airport Road, and it was just a two-lane road. There was a bus driver, salt of the earth bus driver from the villages, who had taken up that post to guard soldiers who would be driving in to crush the students. And he saw that evening, that night, a convoy of dozens and dozens of truckloads of soldiers coming. And he took his bus and he drove it across the road to block it. And then he turned off the engine and stepped out. The convoy ground to a halt. And an officer got out of the lead truck and ordered him, "Move the bus." And the bus driver said no. And the officer pulled out his sidearm and pointed it at the bus driver and said again, "Move the bus." The bus driver, he had the bus keys in his hand. It was night. He hurled the keys as far as he could into the grassy verge by the side of the road. I've thought about that guy in recent years as democracy has been tested in this country. And I've actually thought that rather than not really understanding democracy very fully, that maybe people like that actually had a richer appreciation of democracy than many of us do, because precisely because we've inherited its blessings, we don't always understand the alternatives, don't always appreciate it. And for people like him who had lived through the Great Famine, who had lived through the Cultural Revolution, who had endured all kinds of oppression and economic crises as a result, they completely understood how important freedom and democracy were. And I've come to think that there's actually a great deal that we can learn from people like that bus driver. You never forget watching a modern army mow down students and democracy protesters using weapons of war. It is seared into you. And I think it changed the kind of journalism that I tend to do. Ever since then, I've written an awful lot more about human rights, about underdogs, about atrocities. I ended up later spending a lot of time covering the Darfur genocide, which was, again, just not enemy. And you see these terrible things and these villagers being massacred and their bodies thrown into wells to poison the wells, and women not only raped but then scarred so that everybody would know that they'd been raped to shame them and their families forever. And you want to fight back. And my tools to fight back are my camera and my laptop. But those are effective tools, effective weapons, only if you go there. And trying to navigate how you reconcile your responsibilities to the story with your obligations to your family. That's something that I think a lot of journalists wrestle with. I was talking with somebody who's in the audience here whose sister is a conflict photographer. And I, you know, my basic rule of covering conflicts is you never get in a car that is controlled by a photographer, because when they hear gunfire, they go right toward it. And but you do have, if you're a journalist covering these things, you have to get there. But you also have to make sure you get back. In Darfur, my single most successful, I mean, I periodically would cross the border illegally from Chad to get into Darfur and get my information and then, you know, race back to safety in Chad. But my most successful trip into Darfur came when Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, was making a brief trip for about an hour or so to Darfur on his plane on his way to Nairobi. And he agreed to take me on the plane and to cover his stop there. And then as we were coming down for the landing, I went back to him and I said, look, I just want you to know that I might miss the plane out. And he looked at me and he just said, be careful. And so sure enough, he gave his talk. And an hour later, I was in the back of the crowd and watched his plane take off. And I had this incredible freedom because the Sudanese authorities didn't know I was there. They weren't able to follow me. I was there in the middle of a genocide, and I felt I had this unfettered freedom. It was actually a little more complicated because I quickly realized there were checkpoints all over Darfur with these same thugs who were busy committing the genocide. But then I realized there were also a lot of UN people crossing the checkpoints with UN passes in English. And I realized these goons at the checkpoints, they probably couldn't have read Arabic, let alone English. And so I took my sunglasses lanyard, and I took my United Airlines Mileage Plus card. And we got to the first checkpoint, and I waved my Mileage Plus card. And it is amazing the respect that these genocidaires have for United Airlines. It was maybe also partly a legacy of Tiananmen and also a legacy of Darfur and seeing the way rape was used as a weapon of war that Cheryl and I increasingly began to write about gender issues. And, you know, part of it was that when we covered Tiananmen, that was such a searing experience for us to cover that massacre. And we don't really know, but somewhere around 400 to 800 people were probably killed that night, massacred. And then we came across a study that year and every year in China, there were 30,000 infant girls who were dying, effectively discriminated against to death because they were girls, because they weren't getting the same access to food and health care as boys. And we'd written all about Tiananmen. We'd never written a peep about this lethal discrimination at a far greater level. And so we began to report a little bit more about that and about healthcare and discrimination, about human trafficking. And again, it kind of fed on itself. And you know, one way of thinking about it, a question for you, are there more males or females in the world today? I sense a little bit of disagreement, actually. So again, quiz time. So who thinks there are more males in the world today? Who thinks there are more females in the world today? The first group was right. In the United States, there are more females. In Europe, there are more females. I think in this room, there are more females. In a society where, with human rights, there are more females. Women will live longer. They have lower mortality rates. But the world is not equal. And one measure of the way discrimination is lethal is that there are globally you have about 100 million women who are missing, and that tips the balance. So globally, there are actually more males than females. You know, I did what I thought was going to be one article about human trafficking in Cambodia, and got to a village where there were a bunch of young girls who'd been kidnapped, and they were being auctioned off for their virginity. And they were terrified. And I just could not believe this was happening. This felt like 19th century slavery, except these kids were going to be dead of AIDS by their early 20s. And it's hard to go back from that and just write about other topics again. And then that made me curious about trafficking issues in other countries, in India, in Malaysia, in Vietnam, and then, of course, in the U.S. And the trafficking problems in the U.S. are not as acute as they are in, say, India. But we don't have the moral authority to tell other countries to clean up their act unless we make some greater effort to do so at home. And so that led me to write about more of these issues at home. But as I was writing about these global humanitarian crises, I would come home to try to heal on the family farm that I grew up on in Oregon. And I always thought of it as God's country, right where the Willamette Valley goes into the coastal range. Beautiful place. My little hometown of Yamhill is a population about 1,000 on a good day. And when I was growing up, it really was reflective of upward mobility. And the kids who got on the school bus right after me were the five Knapp kids. Farlan Knapp was my grade, and then his younger brother, Zeelan, their brother, Nathan, the sister, Regina, and baby brother, Keelan. Their dad had a union job laying sewer pipe. Their mom drove tractor for a local farm, and they had parlayed that into something approaching a middle-class life. And when Farlan turned 16, his family got him a Ford Mustang, and I was so jealous. But in Yamhill, as in a lot of working class communities around the country, those good union jobs went away. The mill jobs closed, the factories closed, and meth arrived. Actually, Farlan was one of the first people to cook meth in our area. And I always thought he would have made a brilliant pharmacist because he apparently made very good meth. But he instead, he didn't graduate from high school, and he cooked meth, and he used it. He died of liver failure from drug and alcohol abuse. His brother, Zeelan, died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. Their brother, Nathan, blew himself up cooking meth. Their sister, Regina, died of hepatitis from IV drug use. And their baby brother, Keelan, had survived in part because he spent 10 years in the state penitentiary for drug offenses, but then he was released with the pandemic and died of an overdose at the beginning of the pandemic. And their mom is in her 80s, and she walks up the hill every day to visit the graves of her five dead kids. And, you know, this wasn't entirely exceptional. On my school bus, on my old number 6 school bus right now, of the kids who were on it, about 1/3 are gone from drugs, alcohol, and suicide. And trying to understand how that happens in a community that you love, that you had always thought reflected all these good, strong rural values, is really hard. And I think one thing that was also hard for me was that, having written a lot about sexual violence and the burden of it, now there were two boys on my bus who were both sentenced to prison for raping very young girls. How does that happen on one bus, two boys? How does that happen? And it just reflected the whirlwind that came through my town and so many other working class communities around the country. And it also brought with it a political tide. And I think it made people much more willing to turn, from my point of view, to a charlatan who was willing to promise that the mill jobs were going to come back, that the factories were going to reopen, that this can all be blamed on migrants or Muslims or whatever. But it was profoundly destabilizing, and for the community and for the country, and led me to reflect a lot about how we can address this. I think that there are a lot of folks in my hometown. My hometown voted about 2-1 for President Trump, both in 2016 and the last election. And I think partly that reflected this real anger at institutions, at the systems, at the status quo. But frankly, they kind of have a right to feel that way. I mean, and you sense that working class frustration around the country. And there is some basis for it. You know, until recently, we were losing more than 100,000 Americans a year to overdoses. Only about 20% were getting access to treatment. And we never had a response, a policy response, that was commensurate with the scale of that problem, with the harm that was causing in families all across the country. We never had efforts to provide job training and improve education to create new jobs for those who lost their positions in the mill, et cetera. And it was often, I think, accompanied by a real condescension from my crowd, from the educated world, toward those who were less fortunate. And I don't think, you know, I think my world of liberals understood that you can't have a serious conversation about poverty if you don't consider race. But I don't think they understood that you also can't have a serious conversation about poverty if you don't also consider class, if you don't consider family structure. And people, and then I think after the first President Trump election in 2016, I think we, my world of liberals, I think we magnified everything by having way too many people who said that the only people who support President Trump are racists and bigots. And A, I think we should be really careful about invidious denunciations of large classes of people. But in addition, it's really hard to win votes from people whom you're denouncing as racists and bigots. It really is. So I think about, you know, how, where, what would work? Where do we go from here? And I think about the kids on my bus and what would have helped them. And, you know, historically, I think maybe the best explanation for how the U.S. became the world's leading economy was that we were really good at mass education. European countries were better at elite education, but we really pioneered mass education. We were one of the first countries to have very widespread literacy, then one of the first countries to have widespread high school attendance, one of the first countries to have, again, widespread tertiary education. As late as the 1960s, we had the highest high school graduation rates in the world. And then since about 1970, we let that slide. And I worry that, you know, that we've been way too complacent in this country about educational standards from, you know, from K through, well, from pre-K on through higher education. That is the secret sauce. And I think back to the adults when so many of my classmates were dropping out of school. And you know, we ended up as taxpayers paying so much to incarcerate my old classmates when that money would have been so much better spent investing in their education. And then I think, what are adults thinking in 2025 when we still have 1 in 7 kids in America not graduating from high school? What are we thinking? And so many kids emerge not literate, not numerate, not capable of some kind of a rewarding career with a sense of purpose that can support a family. And So I think we have enormous challenges to fix these challenges. But my book, my latest book is, it's not called Chasing Despair, it's called Chasing Hope. So I want to leave you with a little sense of how I can emerge from covering these kinds of domestic issues, from having a hometown that wrestles with so many challenges, and still feeling a real measure of hope for our ability, our capacity to solve these problems together. And, you know, there, especially when I talk to young people, I hear often so much about perfectly good reasons to be upset. You know, people think they're never going to be able to afford a home. Climate change is risking turning the earth uninhabitable. Democracy in peril at home. Gaza, Ukraine, Sudan, so many examples of inhuman treatment to each other. And those are all legitimate concerns. But I would make a couple of points. First of all, as somebody who has covered these issues, that over the arc of my career, I've also seen extraordinary changes in humanity that fundamentally are positive. And I think if you look back, that when historians look back at this period in which most of us have been adults, then the fundamental change that was taking place was an enormous decline in absolute poverty, an enormous increase in lifespan, in well-being, in literacy, in opportunities for the female half, almost half, of the population. And, you know, one example, when I was a kid, when many of you were kids, a majority of human beings had always been illiterate throughout human history. Now we're pushing 90% adult literacy, 90%. That's largely because female literacy worldwide has increased. That's an incredible change. That's transformative. When I was born, 20% of kids died before the age of 5 worldwide, 20%, one-fifth. Now we're down to a little more than 3% of kids dying before the age of 5. So way too many, but the fraction of kids who died before the age of 5 has dropped in half just since 2000. And, you know, we face enormous challenges. And I'm just back from Uganda, where I was covering the impact of USAID's shutdown. And it's disastrous. You see kids dying unnecessarily, and it wrenches you. But it's still important to understand that long-term trajectory of decline, the way we're able to overcome, in large part, HIV/AIDS, malaria, so many other ailments. And besides that kind of statistical improvement that I see, one of the things you learn from covering war and genocide and atrocities is that side by side with the worst of humanity, you invariably find the very best. And so, for example, in one person who enormously inspired me was this incredible Pakistani woman I became very friendly with called Mukhtar Mai. And Mukhtar was a woman from a little village called Mirwala in rural Pakistan, in the Punjab. And a village council had sentenced her to be gang raped because of something that her brother supposedly had done. And in fact, that was an excuse. He probably never did it. But in any case, the village council sentenced her. Then they carried out the sentence. They gang raped her. And their expectation was that she would then kill herself out of shame. And instead, Mukhtar was this incredible woman. And she prosecuted her attackers. She went to the police. She prosecuted her attackers. She sent them to prison. And then she used compensation money for the rape to start the first school in her village. And she said that She wanted to do that because education was the best way to chip away at the kind of cruelty and misogyny that had victimized her. And then she enrolled the children of her attackers in her school. And you just couldn't be in this village of Mirwala and see her attackers' children in their little school uniforms studying Urdu and English and math and just not feel that we, at our best, are an incredible species. And yes, we're capable of all kinds of incredible brutality. But side by side with that, we have this incredible capacity for strength and resilience and magnanimity. And, you know, this is one of those times that is tests us, and we have to summon those reserves. But boy, we have that capability if we can just tap those reserves, that those better angels within us. And I think that the last thing that I'll say is that I think we psych ourselves out sometimes and think that the problems we confront are just too vast to actually make a difference and resolve, and that anything we do will just be a drop in the bucket. You know, I mean, at some level, that's right. We're not going to solve war in this room tonight. We're not going to solve child malnutrition or AIDS or the mess we have in our country. But in that sense, anything we do will be a drop in the bucket. But I'm a believer in drops in the bucket. I totally am a believer in drops in the bucket. And to explain why, let me tell you about a man named Vladislav Krzysztofowicz, who was a World War II refugee. His family, he had spied on the Nazis in World War II, got caught, fled in every which direction. He was in a concentration camp. And then a family in the U.S. sponsored his way to America. Now, that did not solve the global refugee problem at all. Didn't make a dent in the global refugee problem. Totally a drop in the bucket. But it was completely transformative for Krzysztofowicz. And the reason I know that is that when Vladislav Krzysztofowicz arrived in the U.S., he decided his name was way too long and complex, and he shortened it to Christoph, my dad. So take it from me, drops in a bucket, that is how you fill buckets. And we can find a purpose. We can bring about change. So I want to leave you with that thought, and now we'll make it a broader conversation. Thank you all very much.
We are now going to pivot, and we're going to include you in the public conversation, and I'm allowed to have a couple of minutes to give a reflection to Nicholas. And I want to bring up the bravery of you as a journalist, Daniel Pearl, and you wrote about Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered in Turkey. Not giving an editorial, but the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is allowed to just continue and be blessed. And that is really disconcerting. And then I want to bring up Charlie Kirk. And then I have my son who's in college, who has a friend in college at UCSD, and they are they're texting. My son's friend posted on Instagram something demeaning, glad that Charlie Kirk is dead. And like a lot of TikTok and Instagram, it was like no empathy, no sadness, no tears. Now, my son, who's a libertarian, thought that that was a bridge too far. So that friendship is now broken. They were friends since age 4, but because of Charlie Kirk, that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. I guess it's the first question of the evening. How do we repair this broken organism of America when childhood friends, they're also they're struggling with the American dream. They don't believe that there is an economy for them in the future. They will not have a home. They won't buy a home. So there's a lot of demoralization. As you know, we're at an inflection point What would you be saying to my son and my son's friend?
I'd be saying to your son's friend that, you should not be celebrating somebody's death, that you do need to have this empathy. But I'd also be saying to your son that, friendships are more important, that people say stupid things, and that friendships are more important than somebody saying a stupid thing, that that's not a reason to rupture a friendship. And I guess more broadly, I'd say to them that we're all being manipulated, I think, by social media algorithms to inflame our biases, to inflame our hatreds, to encounter content that is going to make us angry, because people can monetize that. And that we have to push back at that. And we have to push back at the selection biases that afflict all of us. And there's been abundant social science research that suggests that, none of us want the best information. What we most want, there's one good study that found that what we most want is information that makes the other side look really stupid. What we next want is information that makes our side look really smart. And what none of us want is, smart critiques of our own side. And, I wrestle with this all the time. My own solution, which I commend to everybody, is, let me put it this way. So every morning I go for a run. And, it's painful, and I sweat and so on, but I do it because it makes a better me. In the same way, every morning, I read the Wall Street Journal opinion pages. And it makes me sweat and, upset. But I do it because it makes a better me. And I think it's important to kind of push back. And especially, when I hear about families that don't get together at Thanksgiving because of politics, that just kind of breaks my heart, that I just think we're being, being manipulated into our, and there are things more important than these views, and you win people over by listening to them sometimes, and they're not going to listen to you unless you listen to them first.
I'm going to pick up on that. I thought I was going to start with kind of a nice, hopeful softball question, but, let's get right into it. After all the pronouncements, and it's sad that we actually have to say that violence is not a good thing in a political debate, after we get over that violence is not the answer, I just don't understand how we actually address some of the things that, are actually antithetical to progress. Things that Charlie Kirk was talking about, pro-gun nationalism, the great replacement theory, and that white Christianity is a dominant paradigm in a world where that is just irrevocably changing, spreading racist and hateful rhetoric, naming people. These ideas just don't help the world, do they? So how do you address ideas that are violent in and of themselves without being violent?
So I guess I'd say two things. One, I think that just kind of arguing that we've kind of failed at the point we're making these arguments, that when people have lived in this ecosystem, it's really hard to change minds. But I think of my friends and neighbors who subscribe to these views, and I think that is a function of us having failed to provide adequate education and to provide an ecosystem where they can be supported in jobs, and that when people are insecure and afraid, they're more vulnerable to charlatans and racists and others. I think back in the 1960s and how it was that we managed, barely to pass civil rights legislation. And I think in part it was because the economy had been growing for three decades in an inclusive way, and that white people were a little more willing, as a result of that inclusive economic growth, to make a space at the table. And now I think there are an awful lot of Americans who feel that economic opportunity is constricted, and they're very unwilling to make a place at the table. And I think about this in the context of immigration a lot. And I, you know, it really puzzles me because there are so many hateful things being said about immigrants. And we have mixed status families with so many kids who are U.S. citizens whose parents are now being deported or at risk of being deported in ways that just brutalize, it seems to me, all of our norms about how we should respect families. And yet, I think that one of the reasons why these ideas have become so widespread in my community and in others is that for years, you had an awful lot of Americans who were saying, look, we want tighter border control. And my world of liberals said, you know, we got it. And the same thing was happening in Europe. And, you know, I think that Angela Merkel did a great thing for Germany's long-term economy by admitting Syrian refugees. But that is not what Germans wanted. And when year after year in America or in Europe, liberals, I mean, the voters are saying, look, we want tighter controls on immigration. And we're saying, you don't understand. Then you create a platform for ethno-nationalists who are xenophobes, and you reward them. And, you know, how we navigate, I mean, I think Biden in the end, June of 2024, if he had taken that same immigration policy two years earlier, I think it might have made a real difference. It was way too late. But, I mean, these are really difficult problems. I don't know quite how one navigates that, but I think we as liberals have failed in ways that have created legitimacy for our critics.
So I was really intrigued by what you said about your neighbors, your community in Oregon. What could have liberals done differently? What could Democrats have done differently to policy to not give the charlatan so much credibility?
Well, I mean, part of it is attitudes and culture. And I do think that there is a profound kind of condescension. Michael Sandel, the Harvard philosopher, he says that the last acceptable prejudice in America is the prejudice of the educated toward the less educated. And I think he kind of has a point. And again, I think that in liberal circles, there was this very, very widespread penchant for saying that Trump voters are all racist and bigots. And I think that is just a profound mistake. And I have, so many friends in my community who just feel looked down on. And, in our circle, we think that some of the linguistic experimentation that we've engaged in, sharing pronouns and changing terminology, that this is all being more inclusive. And we genuinely believe this, and it is more inclusive in many ways. It's inclusive for our circle, but it excludes people who don't live and inhabit the world of words. And they feel all of a sudden that they're walking on eggshells all over, that they don't quite know what's going on. They feel excluded by this. And So I think that, you know, some of it is policies and providing people with more educational opportunities, et cetera. But I think a lot of it is also that there has been a real arrogance. And whenever I write, I make this point periodically in columns that people are, you know, way too quick to look down on working class Americans. And half my readers object and say, we don't look down on them. That's completely hogwash. And the other half say, well, of course we look down on them because we should look down on them. They are all racist bigots.
But I think you make a really good point. I mean, every time I see some cultural reference to uneducated Americans or bumpkins in the flyover states, and it's been going on forever, I just bristle. You go to the end of the movie Clueless, where, you know, Alicia Silverstone says, you think we got married? This isn't West Virginia. Or Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live doing, you know, Abducted by Aliens, which is all very funny. It's a good gag, but we know who they're poking fun of. I mean, we see that a lot.
Totally. And I mean, people are always, you know, defend. I mean, anything like that is felt 10 times as much by folks in that world.
Let me ask a question about legacy media. With the ABC settlement and CBS, and then George Clooney mounting on Broadway, Good Night and Good Luck, with the Edward R. Murrow revision, are we crippled now with where we are, or is there a way we can bounce back into a responsible place?
In terms of using the tools of journalism to try to provide accountability?
Yes.
So, in general, I think in President Trump's first term, I think a lot of American institutions did pretty well, whether the, you know, law, journalism, and so on. I think rather less well in the second term. And you've seen more universities kowtow. You've seen, you know, Paul Weiss. I hope Paul Weiss didn't co-sponsor this event, but, you know, you would not expect Paul Weiss to kowtow in that way. Universities are, I mean, Columbia. And then in our world of the news media, I think journalists themselves, they utterly feel a sense of mission. This is when accountability journalism has never been more important. And there's some amazing accountability journalism being done. The Times today had just a terrific piece about the UAE and the U.S. providing, the U.S. government providing benefits to the Emiratis, even as the Emiratis were providing financial benefits to the Trump family. It was just great accountability journalism. But while journalists, I think, have done a great job, companies that own news organizations have done an awful job. And that is because they have other financial interests that they are trying to protect. And that is true of Jeff Bezos. That is true of Patrick Soon-Shiong.
Is it true of the Times?
I'm sorry?
Is it true of the New York Times?
No. I mean, the New York Times now, we don't have other financial interests. We don't have other companies that are threatened. And it so we can be locked up in litigation. We can be, you know, punished in various ways. But we don't own other things that can be crippled. So, and it may well be that actually the New York Times shareholders are better off confronting Trump. We will gain some, I don't know quite how that works, but we don't have all these other interests that are at risk. And those are really the folks who are caving, who don't have a journalistic mission. And so I worry about, you know, about CBS and ABC and the Wash Post and the LA Times. That said, there is still an awful lot of good journalism out there that is providing that kind of oversight and accountability. But, you know, we have this one pressure from Washington, from the Trump administration, and we have one that you alluded to earlier, Marco, which is just the business model is collapsing for a lot of this. 2.5 newspapers are going out of business every week in America. 2.5 newspapers every week. And especially in small towns, you know, when those papers go out of business, they are often really the only accountability mechanism that exists in that community. I think governance really weakens when that happens.
Let's stay on the journalism tip for just a bit and kind of picking up on some thoughts you had at the end of your remarks. I've always appreciated your metaphor of journalism that too many reporters kind of look at the news as if it's an airport and focus on the planes that crash and not all the planes that land, which is like 99.999% of the time. I'm going to be contrarian. Why do we care, though, if the planes land? Why tell the good news story if it's always the bad news story that, you know, travels? And what is the unseen dividend?
So in an American context, I think it probably makes sense to cover the planes that crash, not the planes that land. But globally, for example, in opinion polls, 90% of Americans say that global poverty is either getting worse or staying the same. And in fact, you know, as I suggested, one of the great transformations of recent decades is an enormous decline in global poverty. When I graduated from college, 41% of the world's people lived in extreme poverty. Even adjusting for inflation, now it's less than 10%. And that's just enormous. And I think that's because we are always covering those planes that crash, all those things that are going wrong. And at some level, we also have to acknowledge that there are, you know, that the pattern is complex, that there are crises, but there are also areas of real progress. I think we can also do a better job with what in journalism is called solutions journalism, which doesn't just look at problems, but also looks at these imperfect steps that localities around the country have taken to address problems. And, you know, education is one of the issues that is really important to me. You know, Mississippi has actually managed over the last dozen years to get kids to read. Mississippi hasn't solved racism. It hasn't solved poverty. But it has solved the problem of getting third graders to read. And if Mississippi can do that, then no state has an excuse. And there, you know, there are some specific things that they have done that other states can learn from. And they're beginning to a little bit, but not enough.
So when we start to kind of recount stories in the news of everything that's broken, then a lot of the world starts to look at that and thinks, wow, everything is broken. This really stinks. If one focuses on the successes, we had Steven Pinker on the show a few years ago, and I just kind of like wondered to myself afterwards, does he read the news? I mean, he thinks like everything is great, you know, so much improvement, literacy, women's rights, da da da. And at the same time, it almost feels like, you know, we're focusing on all the great gift shops inside the airport and not the planes crashing. So today, Sudan, Gaza, Ukraine, no end in sight to any of these, genocide everywhere. We don't know what's happening to the Rohingya, except they're stuck in a, you know, refugee camp in Bangladesh and still getting killed back. I mean, there's so many things. When you look at the world, I mean, obviously to you, it's not good.
Yeah, every, you know, at the end of every year, I, for many years, I've done, traditionally done a column that says, you know, this, whatever, the last year was the best year in human history by various metrics. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that for 2025. There are, you know, these enormous problems, and the, you know, USAID collapse leads to higher mortality. The wars in Gaza, Ukraine, Sudan, and so on. But that said, in terms of, you know, it about as good a metric as any is the risk that a child will die by the age of five, or the number of kids who were starving to death, things like that. And, you know, 2025 will probably be one of the top 5 years in human history by those metrics. So absolutely what is going on in these wars is appalling, and we should stand up and solve them, and kids are dying needlessly. But I'm afraid that if we just focus on everything that is going wrong, it becomes paralyzing and numbing, and we retreat, while a measure of hope, you know, a kind of a pragmatic hope that not that everything will work out fine, but that if we work at it, we can have better outcomes, I think that's empowering. And that can be a way to solve some of these conflicts, to actually get kids to read as well as they do in Mississippi. Who would ever thought you'd ever say something like that? You know, that this kind of a acknowledgement that there are a lot of planes taking off and that we can fix some of these problems, I think that is important to kind of empower ourselves and get us to actually address these problems rather than just retreat and put our dig our head in the sand.
We have a lot of questions from the audience.
Can I ask one more, and then we'll go to the questions from the audience? Sorry, this is really important, partly because the UN General Assembly is meeting this week and next. The UN was supposed to be the body that was going to prevent another world war from happening. It seems, though, that the UN essentially has been unable to disconnect that idea from the very thing that maybe World War II actually fueled a little bit, and that was nationalism. So I'd love to hear from you how you think that we move ahead in the world as long as every country has self-interest as opposed to kind of communal interest or planetary interest.
I mean, Marco, I don't know what your take is, but I think in many ways the whole post-1945 order is beginning to unravel, and not unravel on its own. I think President Trump is unraveling it, and, you know, that is partly the UN agencies are being marginalized, and the U.S. is defunding them, pulling out of them. NATO.
That started before Trump, though. I mean, John Bolton said nobody would notice if the UN General Assembly disappeared.
Yeah. He, what was his line about if you could take out five floors of the UN building and nobody would notice?
Something like that.
But in fact, the UN was a huge player, and global institutions were a huge player in one of the great health successes in the period since Bolton wrote that, which was overcoming AIDS through the PEPFAR program, which was sponsored by a Republican president, George W. Bush, who was suspicious of multilateral institutions and yet used multilateral institutions to save 26 million lives so far. Maybe the best policy in my adult life. And so I mean, I think there's a real risk of unraveling right now, but I don't think that the end is necessarily written. And I mean, one of the things I worry most about is NATO being destroyed. And, you know, what President Trump's refusal to confront Russia over what it has done to Ukraine, and now it's, you know, it's testing Poland and Romania, NATO countries, I think is a huge international mistake. I think it increases the risk of a war with China, which is maybe the worst geopolitical threat over the next 10 or 15 years. I don't think it's likely, but I think the risk of it increases when we don't confront Russia. So I think there are enormous problems with that post-World War II order being undermined. But I don't, you know, there's... It's not over. And you see European countries now actually doing more to stand up for Ukraine. I'm hoping that this can be salvaged. I think a lot will depend, frankly, on what happens in the midterms next time around, who wins the Senate. And I hope that Democrats will not just, you know, wave their fist at President Trump, but will actually work to get people like Sherrod Brown elected. And part of that is going to involve, in the part of West Coast Democrats, we have to do a better job fixing our blue places. Our blue places help elect Republicans in places like Ohio. And that's going to be hard work. But, you know, San Francisco, L.A., Portland, Seattle, and I guess San Diego, you know, they have become advertisements for Democratic failure. We've got to do a better job fixing our blue places while also holding Washington accountable.
Go to the questions from the audience.
It's Alan. Time to empower the audience. Some people out there think that the best question gets a free Tesla with an extension cord. That's a rumor. It's not true. So one question, how will the New York Times lawsuit work out against AI?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the outcome will be. But, you know, we talked about the challenges that journalism faces, from the pressure from the Trump administration to the business model collapsing. And AI is the other enormous threat to news organizations because, you know, people aren't going to be doing Google searches that drive traffic to news organizations. So they'll be asking ChatGPT, which, you know, pillages our reporting, to then tell people what the answer is. And that's my jaundiced view of it. I think the business model of good journalism is going to depend a good deal on figuring out ways of having AI pay for the news coverage that it pillages.
This question, what do you think are the greatest points of consensus among most Americans today, and how can we most effectively build upon this?
You know, so I think that social media tries to drive us apart, inflames us, and so on. But I do think that there is a good wells, and the loudest voices, the most extreme voices get covered. But I do think that there really is a large commonality of people who are fairly reasonable in the country, who do actually want to solve, real problems. And I think that one of the things that I would fault my world of journalism for is that, again, we focus on all the areas where there are disputes, and that's understandable because that's what journalism does. But there are a lot of things that we all kind of agree. I was talking today with Austin Buettner, who used to run LA schools and now runs a group called Vision to Learn. And, so much of education is ferociously divided. We can't even, left and right, even disagree about how kids should learn to read, what's in the library and so on. But meanwhile, almost a quarter of kids need glasses. And our kids, if they need glasses, will get glasses. In low-income schools, most won't. And, a kid is not going to thrive if they can't see the board. And this is a simple, inexpensive problem that has been much tested, has really positive outcomes, but it's not addressed because there's no real dispute. Everybody agrees that kids should have glasses, and so we don't address it. In reproductive health, we are all over the abortion issue. Obviously, I believe in abortion rights, but that is what is covered in reproductive health. Meanwhile, a woman dies every 2 hours of cervical cancer in this country. Something no woman should die of cervical cancer in 2025. We can prevent all those deaths. And yet, because it's not an issue for debate, it's not on the agenda and is missed. And I do think a lot of Americans are sensible enough that there is some opportunity for consensus about addressing some of these real-world problems. That was my theory in my 10-minute political career. That was not a successful political strategy, it turned out.
This one might win the Tesla. What do you think of mandatory universal service in this country, i.e. work for state, federal government, or military, and then the government will pay for your college or vocational school?
Some people like that idea. I don't like the mandatory part, but I very much like the idea of that as an option. My concern about making it mandatory is just that then it becomes politically impossible to adopt. But in my community, the one institution that really offered upward mobility for working class kids was the U.S. military. And if those kids who joined the military, they actually did have a path out to a better life. If you look at Navajo Nation, every institution has failed Native Americans, every institution except the U.S. military. And so much of the Navajo leadership is actually from veterans. And yet most kids today who would benefit from a military career aren't eligible for it because they don't have a high school degree, because they have a criminal record, because they can't pass a drug test or can't pass a cognitive or physical test. And so we have to figure out other ways of getting people out of their environment, see the world in some path to service, to learn discipline, to be around other people. And I think that would be a great investment. And pairing that with some kind of return to educational opportunities or trade schools, which are, again, enormously important, I think that would be a great step forward. Maryland is doing something a little bit like that.
Nicholas, please address the shift from trusted traditional media to podcasts, et cetera, many of which are promoting untruths but are widely received.
I think it's kind of a further devolution from having a shared source of news. Originally the business model for journalism in America was based on wire services that wanted to be subscribed by both Democratic and Republican newspapers, so they tried to write down the middle so that, and that's kind of shaped the mores of American journalism to be reasonably neutral in a way that was different from European journalism and colonial journalism. And now I think we've again, created a world in which news organizations and podcasts realize that they can target people based on and tell people what they want. And, I think a lot of us would kind of enjoy having smart people confirm all of our prejudices and tell us how awful the other guys are. And so I think there's going to be a market for that. I think it's kind of not the best thing for a civil society.
But the cat's out of the bag now.
I think it probably is. I do think, periodically we've managed to pull ourselves back from incredible division in our history. And, not just the colonial period or Civil War or Reconstruction or the 1960s, but there have been periods when we managed to come back. And I used to think I studied in England in the early 1980s, and Britain was so divided by geography. All the North was Labour, all the South was Conservative. Conservatives read the Telegraph, liberals read the Guardian. People didn't know each, the accent, they couldn't even talk to each other if you were from Manchester, Liverpool versus the South. And yet Britain did manage to overcome that. I would like to think that there are paths forward for this country that can be healing as well.
Are you hopeful right now?
I'm deeply tested, but I'm hopeful in the sense. So I'm not hopeful in the sense that I'm confident things will work out. But I am hopeful in the sense that I think that if we work at it, there is a path forward that, I think democracy is, faces real strains. But I think that I think Democrats will win the House next time around. I think they just maybe have a shot at the Senate. And I think that would be a real check on autocratic inclinations on the part of the White House and would put us on a much better path. And climate change, has really been, I think, a kind of existential risk for not just this country, but the world. And in many ways, that is a lot more promising than it was 10 years ago. The economics of solar are so much better now. It just outperforms fossil fuels. Nuclear, who knows, may likewise be an option down the road. But what is happening in solar, in battery technology, if you squint just a little bit, you can kind of see a path out of our whole climate conundrum. And that is totally different than what it was 10 years ago.
If you could suggest one thing that each person in this room could do to positively change our current state of polarization, what would that be?
Well, go to Thanksgiving dinners with family members you disagree with. I'm kidding, but I do think it's important to get together with people who are outside your circle. I think one can have civil conversations and don't, turn up your nose at people who disagree. Listen, because again, you can't convince somebody if you don't first listen to them. I have, I'm surrounded in Yamhill by people who have a completely different worldview from me. And I'm a deep believer in gun safety measures. I think it's just terrific that we lose 40-some thousand people a year or two to gun deaths. And there are policies we can really use to address that. And so I have conversations with friends about, you know, even people who pretty much have Second Amendment tattooed on their forehead. And you can have a conversation. You can have a civil conversation about that. And it's I use a technique that social scientists call complexifying an issue. And that is, you don't talk about the issue at 30,000 feet, or you don't talk about Second Amendment versus, you know, gun control and banning guns. You talk about a difficult, marginal issue in the weeds. And so I'll ask my friends, I'll say, okay, we all believe that if you have a felony conviction, you should not be able to buy a firearm. What about somebody who has a violent misdemeanor conviction in the last 3 years? A stalking conviction. What about that? Or right now in Wyoming, you have to be 21 to buy a handgun in a private purchase. In Oregon, it's only 18. Shouldn't we have the same age limit as a good red state like Wyoming? And people may disagree, but they're willing to have that conversation. And then they, you know, they harass me with, you know, well, you know, the assault weapons ban, you know, that produced 40 million AR-15s in America. And, you know, I mean, but if you talk about, if you complexify these issues and talk at the margins, you can have a civil conversation with people you disagree with. And remember that humans are complex, and just because somebody is completely wrong doesn't make them an evil person.
One of the headlines in today's New York Times was White House plans broad crackdown on liberal groups, with J.D. Vance announcing this on Charlie Kirk's podcast. This is a very scary moment. How do we as average citizens respond to this?
It is a scary moment. And, you know, that they mentioned, Soros's efforts and the Ford Foundation. It's, you know, ridiculous to think that, and The Nation magazine. I mean, it's this is completely a pretext to go after some of these institutions that have been a thorn in the side of President Trump. I don't think that he will succeed. I think that he will make a go of it, and I hope that we will stand against that. I hope we will stand with educational institutions, law firms, civil society institutions that are standing up for these rights. And I think at the end of the day, I mean, the Supreme, if we'd had this conversation 6 months ago, I would have said, oh, you know, the courts will stand up for these rights. And federal district courts have done a pretty good job, don't you think? The Supreme Court, not so much. But I hope that the Supreme Court will come through on issues like that. Certainly the district courts have done a good job.
This is a good one. Should Bill Maher have had dinner with Donald Trump and normalized Donald Trump? And was Larry David right in making fun of Bill Maher?
Oh, look, I mean, I have dinner with warlords. I have dinner with people committing genocide. I deeply believe in engaging people with whom I disagree. If President Trump invited me to dinner, I would absolutely go. I'd want to bring a taster along.
That's China talking, huh?
Yeah. But I. You know, I do think it's, I have confidence in my views, in liberal views, that we can hold our own and win the battle of ideas. And I don't think there's a problem of legitimizing somebody who's already the president of the United States. And so I believe in engaging, in being polite, but also in being very clear and blunt about what you think, about what you think is wrong and incorrect, and holding on to that moral compass. But you can hold on to a moral compass and still, I think, have dinner with President Trump. You just want to bring your taster.
So you're saying Larry David was wrong?
So he was criticizing Bill Maher for having dinner with Trump?
Yeah, he has that piece in the New York Times.
Okay. Yeah, I think he was wrong.
We just have a couple of minutes left, so I'm going to ask the last question because I want to end on a note of hope. hard.
I'll try.
Tell us a story about one of your recent university essay winners who went with you on assignment. Who was it? Where'd you go? What were they interested in? What did they write about?
At the beginning of this year, we went to Madagascar to look at what was happening with malnutrition and reproductive health in rural Africa. And at one level, it's sort of heartbreaking. And the U.S. is defunding the UN Population Fund, which is the world's biggest source of condoms around the world. It costs 2.7 cents each. And, you know, without them, we get more HIV, we get more STDs, we certainly get more pregnancies. As a result, we get more maternal deaths. And malnutrition, you know, 20% of kids worldwide are stunted from malnutrition in an age when we have so many resources. But my winner, Trisha Mukherjee, was also looking at ways we can address these kinds of problems, solutions, again. And these sometimes are a little boring, but they make this incredible difference. And for example, there's a kind of prenatal vitamin that MMS, which include iron and folic acid, but also various other micronutrients, cost $2.17 for the course of a pregnancy and dramatically reduces neonatal mortality, reduces maternal mortality for $2.17. You know, this is something we can afford. There is this sort of incredible product may have heard of called Plumpy Nut, that it's a peanut paste inspired actually by peanut butter and with fortified, comes in these little sachets. Two of them cost $1. And they bring kids back from severe acute malnutrition like nothing you can imagine. These kids are desperate, and you give it to them, and they it brings them back to life. And so Trisha, my winner, was writing about that. And also, you know, we looked at AIDS, and I've got to say that one of the things that has most inspired me, as I was talking to somebody about this earlier, was somebody who covered AIDS a lot in the early 2000s. I went some years ago with my winner. We went to Lesotho and Malawi, and we interviewed coffin makers. And the coffin makers were kind of grumbling that people aren't dying anymore. You Americans with PEPFAR, you've destroyed our business model for coffins. And, you know, they were kind of joking, and they were happy that people weren't dying anymore. But this was because of something that we as taxpayers had done. We had licked a disease. We've saved, you know, 26 million lives from this disease. We've almost ended mother-to-child transmission in childbirth through HIV. I used to go around in Southern Africa, and you'd see these homes of just these, they're called child-headed households, just kids, you know. The oldest kid is 13, so he or she is looking after a bunch of younger siblings and kids from other households whose parents and grandparents died as well. And those child-headed households are basically gone because of PEPFAR, because of what we as American citizens did, because we were willing to tackle HIV/AIDS in distant corners of the world. So when we confront moral challenges, we are capable of extraordinary things. Right now, unfortunately, we're retreating from confronting those moral challenges with the collapse of USAID and we're allowing people to die of AIDS, including kids to die of AIDS, because we're not willing to allot 12 cents a day per child for the antiretrovirals that will keep them alive. I would like to think that we, in our greater wisdom, can find our path again and revive PEPFAR and the President's Malaria Initiative and some of these other niches. And, you know, we can't save every child in the world, but just because we can't save every child does not mean that we should save none. We can make a real difference. We have, and I think we will again.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.